1103B and I think 1140A, but I'm reading 1105B, where he says, it is well said then that it is by doing just actions that the just man is produced, and by doing temperate acts, the temperate man. Without doing these, no one would have even a prospect of becoming good. And then this is the, so that's him saying, actually, it's doing like actions. It's not necessarily reflection. It's actions that make you a better person. And then this is the negative where he says, and just thinking about it isn't going to do you any good. Then he says, but most people do not do these and take refuge in theory and think they are being philosophers and will become good in this way, behaving somewhat like patients who listen attentively to their doctors, but do none of the things they are ordered to do. As the latter will not be made well in body by such a course of treatment, the former will not be made well by such a course of philosophy. So that's, so yeah, it's not necessarily theories, and philosophy might even be a kind of useful excuse from flying away from your ethical cultivation or your moral development.
A kind of fleeing.
Yeah, exactly.
A kind of intellectual fleeing.
Yeah, precisely. So I think that does take us to the other paper, which I'm trying to kind of use as a mirror to hold up against the Schwitzgebel and show philosophers in a different, I guess as Langer would say, in a different key. Philosophers who are not necessarily engaged, who are absolutely engaged in ethical and moral reflection, but whose ethical characters are not necessarily a product or even shown through their moral reflections, but are actually shown through their moral actions and the kinds of ethical schools that they cultivated. And the way that the author of the next paper, Pierre Hadot, does this is he explores Theroux, who is the sort of main character and author of the great American work Walden. Sort of ominous. This is, and the title of this paper is actually great, and I love it. And it's what drew me very quickly to making the comparison to Schwitzgebel's conception of moral philosophers. The title of the paper is, there are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers. That is, there are people who do the kind of theorizing that we're talking about, but Theroux is pointing out that these people don't walk the walk. You know, they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. So Hadot brings up Theroux as a kind of example of a person who, I don't know how necessarily educated Theroux would have been in moral philosophy or anything like that, but he certainly has opinions about the profession itself and the sort of vacuity of the moral philosophers. He says, you know, quoting the title of the paper, there are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers. Hadot says that is because for him, quote, to be a philosopher is not merely to have subtle thoughts, but so to love wisdom as to live according to its dictates, a life of simplicity, independence, magnanimity, and trust. It is to solve some of the problems of life, not only theoretically, but practically. So Hadot wants to elect Theroux as an example of someone who is not just solving some of the problems of ethics theoretically, but also practically. If you're aware of Theroux and the work Walden, Theroux was someone who sort of chose an American ascetic life, moving into the woods and reducing his tasks and his needs as much as he could. And in fact, this actually goes into and is in line with what he thought was the highest good for a person.
He lived in the mid-19th century, right? the grand necessity then is talking about what the importance of life for our bodies is to keep warm, to keep the vital heat in us. So he's got this kind of, like, I know it comes up with papers and in his own writing, the kind of vital heat, this sort of like essence of personal energy, self, what do you want to call it? Like, you kind of, your pure humanness. I'm trying my best to recontextualize this, the vital heat, that kind of energy. And you know, and obviously Thoreau thinks that there's all sorts of things about the modern world, and by modern we mean the mid-19th century, that sort of suppress that, right? There's all sorts of ways in which people live and the structures that live in and the organizations, the social circles, all this kind of stuff, and the activities that they do or don't do that sort of suppress that vital fire, that vital heat. And so therefore, you know, he was going to sort of try and, like, when people, like, try to talk about, like, going to, like, out camping or on a road trip or whatever to, like, connect themselves, find themselves, Thoreau was, like, definitely a forerunner of the I'm going to figure myself out by moving into the woods movement that you now see on YouTube.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because for Thoreau, he sort of does it backwards, at least by our conception of how you're supposed to do it. So for us, you know, you go to a camp or you go to a retreat or you just go walk in the woods and you're supposed to find yourself or something, right? For Thoreau, it's almost the other way. The grand necessity then for our bodies is to keep warm, to keep the vital heat in us. I more or less just took that as we just need to stay alive, right? Anything that sustains us is what is good for us, and we should only do what is, you know, necessary and sufficient for that. No more, no less, no real luxuries and stuff like that. So Thoreau isn't going into the woods to find out that, oh, wow, you know, all that's really important to me is just to stay alive, is just to kind of live intentionally, as Hadeau is going to say.
Oh. Yeah, as Thoreau says farther on, most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind.
Yes, and that's also the problem that he has with professional philosophers as well, is that they sort of keep us trapped in these, what he calls, absurdities, right? That if there are things that are positive hindrances to us just kind of sustaining ourselves, and like, I can think, for example, you know, like, I don't know, certain like beauty standards or something like that that harm us or that make us work harder than we need to or something like that. Thoreau is seeing that, well, because that's not actually sustaining your vital heat, because it's not keeping you in this world, it's just kind of this self-existent, almost like parasitic project. It can be cut off without actually affecting what really matters, which is essentially just staying alive. And the professional philosophers perpetuate these absurdities with their theoretical understanding of these problems. They want to solve problems in theory, but since the problems that are actually important are practical problems, they create problems for themselves that don't need to be solved at all. And that's how professional philosophers kind of trap us in these problems.
I think that's absolutely correct. And another thing I think as well, with sort of Thoreau's vision or vision of the world more, is that he definitely views a certain degree of, like, in what he's doing and keeping that vital heat, there's a certain degree of, like, protecting or really growing his own, like, personal independence. He seems to really believe that there's, that in, like, modern social structures, modern society, there's a propensity towards conformity that clearly leaves out a certain style or way of being that, at least for him, and as we went through here, is something that's more essential and is more practical and is more in tune. He actually says about, as we're talking about philosophers, he says, the paper says, because in being content with theoretical discourse, they encourage men to keep living in an absurd manner. The life of these philosophers is pure conformity, and they let humanity degenerate in luxury.
So that's one of the important things that Hadeau also gestures towards too. I was going to say that I'm for someone so familiar with, you know, ancient and especially Hellenistic philosophy, Hado was, that he didn't bring up cynicism. I'm thinking Diogenes of Sinope, who was famous for continuously cutting himself down and down and down, that when he saw a young child drinking, so he would carry around a wooden bowl to drink and eat from, and when he saw a child drinking from a fountain with his hands, he threw the bowl away because he realized, oh, I don't need this bowl anymore. I've seen how to do it, how to be continuously and even more self-sufficient. So self-sufficiency was a cynic, value, right? Autarkeia. But now that I'm thinking about this dichotomy or this sort of contrast between Epicureanism and Stoicism that Hado is continuously balancing through on, it actually makes a lot of sense that self-sufficiency would actually be contained within the Epicurean distinction between necessary and unnecessary pleasures. So there are things that are necessary for us. This is the dichotomy drawn by the Epicureans, and one that he's connecting to Thoreau, that Thoreau kind of independently, I don't know if Thoreau encountered Epicurus, but in any case, Thoreau has practically solved this problem and encountered in his own life this distinction between a necessary and an unnecessary pleasure, right? And it's interesting that by sort of setting aside all of the unnecessary pleasures of, you know, aesthetics or conformity, and even the sort of intellectual pleasures of philosophical puzzlement, I suppose there's some pleasure in that. He encounters all kinds of other pleasures, right? Hado brings up the pleasures of the tint of the night, of the pleasures of realizing the value of like a gloomy rain, or his crops washing away. Well, it's good for the grass, which is good for me, right? But this also connects him to the other side of the dichotomy as well, which is this, if on the one side we have Epicureanism, on the other side is Stoicism. And the Stoic element of Thoreau's ethical, practical life is realizing his place amongst the cosmos, right? And you can see how that these are connected, the Epicurean. There's a certain Epicurean pleasure in recognizing your place in the world. And also by recognizing your place in the world, you engage in one of the necessary pleasures, right? So they're kind of connected, and Hado is painting a portrait of Thoreau as someone who has successfully sort of synthesize the two temperaments between the pleasure-seeking Epicureans and the cosmological Stoics, right? And it's through this way of synthesizing these traditions and showing that by taking on a moral philosophy that is practical, no less theoretical, by the way. These Stoics and the Epicureans were absolutely academic, or they weren't academics in their own time, but we would recognize them now as engaged in a lot of philosophical.
But there's also this, like, this structural difference, right? Like, Thoreau is coming up in this era of, you know, the kind of definitely the early modern to modern period sees the sort of formalization of, like, the education system and, you know, and the professional philosopher and stuff, like you've all been saying. Whereas, like, the Epicureans and the Stoics didn't really have to contend with that method. Like, there were certainly teachers and schools, but from my understanding, their functionality was definitely different. And there was also, as you've already talked about, there was a far greater emphasis on what's being passed on being practiced, right? Like, it not being... like, ethical schools were certainly, you know, schools to teach people, like, ways of living, and you were supposed to, you know, live that, you know, that way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess in a certain way, there is a question of the, nowadays at least, the sort of practical handing down of these sorts of problems. I mean, I can think of, like think of the Wittgensteinian analytics or something like that. They do philosophy in a certain way. It's not moral philosophy, really, but there is a practical element to the way that theoretical philosophical schools are handed down. I mean, you can only do analysis if you have like a certain kind of temperament or a certain kind of character or something like that. But in any case, there is, especially, I think the contrast that you're drawing between ancient and modern is, and their environmental factors is, it's well seen that back then in the ancient world, there would have been far less kind of academic temptations, and there would have been a greater emphasis on sort of putting these things into practice. I think one of the other things that kind of facilitates this as well is that, at least from my picture, of the way that ancient schools kind of, and I don't know, maybe I'm like showing my hand myself a little bit in this way, but there's more of an emphasis or an, like, there's more of an image of community. Maybe I'm being nostalgic, but in the ancient schools, when you become an Epicurean, you went to the garden of Epicurus. When you studied with the Stoics, you went to the Stoa, you know, you hung out with the people who studied at the porch. If you went to the Plato's Academy, you went to his academy. If you were a peripatetic, you went to the Lyceum. There was more of, philosophy was, it wasn't just about social milieu, but when you made a decision to become this or that, you engaged in a social world. Whereas, and again, I think this is what I'm maybe telling myself, when you go to an when you go to a university today, you are absolutely like concretely surrounding yourself with certain people, and you're giving yourself social opportunities, but those are far less theoretically important now, and they're more just like plainly social, you know?
Yeah. They're just more like facts about your environment. You know, the way I think about it, and now obviously Thoreau is a very different perspective on this because he's like effectively like a self-isolationist, right? He's like a good guy, Ted Kaczynski. But clearly with like the older schools, I think you're absolutely right. And there's almost like this with the older schools, and we're talking, when we talk about this, we're primarily talking, I believe, like kind of, although I think this has similar aspects around the world. We're obviously talking more from like a Greco-Roman perspective. But the, I think a lot of these organizations and these schools, if you want to call them that, were more almost like cultic in a way. And I don't mean that in the pejorative sense. Like the important thing to remember about the ancient, you know, the ancient West world, the Roman world, was like, there was a lot of cultic activity, right? There were all sorts of different groups and religious organizations, all this kind of stuff that you could kind of pseudo join, be a part, like kind of like clubs.
Yeah. The first real philosophical milieu was the Pythagorean cult.
With a lot of these schools you would join, the point is that you don't get in a university now, is that you're like a member, right? Like you're like, you've kind of joined this order. Like, this is your lifestyle. This is a central component of who you are. Universities operate very differently because, like, well, on the one hand, there's the students, but even thinking about the professors, like, it's a career designed to function in a certain kind of effectively, like, economic environment, really, right? Like, and that's a very different thing. And that position, say, being a prof, like, you'll certainly encounter all sorts of different philosophy, but in a way that's almost like, you could construe that as almost like a bad thing, like almost like a luxury, as Thoreau would put it, like it's too much of a good thing, or doesn't allow a particular philosopher to really like focus in and be like, I'm this, I'm going to study this, I'm devoting my life to this, instead of I'm devoting my life to a broad topic which I can sort of chip away at all sorts of different spots, but never fully imbibe like one particular way of being. Or my way of being is this almost more kind of like fragmented schizophrenic way of like jumping from here to here to here in terms of like stuff I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I like that you brought up the kind of economic element too, because in a certain way, even if it is extremely focused and almost like, especially when it's extremely focused, it still kind of misses the mark. Like I have in my experience, I've encountered two people. It hasn't happened once. It's happened twice where my peers have said, like, explicitly referencing like their favorite professor, they're going to succeed them. They're going to have their job. So, you know, like when they retire, you know, I'm going to do what they're doing. And that seems like a kind of passing on the torch. But when you actually like look at it, it's like your goal is to get a certain job, right? Like I would be, like, it seems that in this kind of framework, what succeeding and embodying that philosophy is just a continued perpetuation of teaching that philosophy, right? It doesn't really leave room for like, hey, maybe this philosophy or this philosopher, their ideas are not just like, I don't want to say like incompatible with university life, but like they might be more fulfilled elsewhere in day-to-day life, that you can succeed these ideas and really propagate them elsewhere, that the university environment is like not self-contained, that you really can do philosophy in your day-to-day life and really put it into practice, as it were, you know?
The interesting thing about reading a lot of ancient philosophy, especially ancient ethical philosophy like Stoicism and Epicureanism and stuff like that, is obviously there's usually some sort of metaphysics or cosmology. And we also have to be careful because a lot of this stuff has been lost. So it's kind of like we're talking about a concept or idea that really may have serious components missing. There's also a degree to which philosophy has gotten more complicated, right? Like we've gotten like it's like the bar gets of like the distance from real life gets pushed more and more and more, or becomes more and more focused on very minute and specific things, right? That again, don't, as you're talking about, don't translate really in any sort of meaningful way other than an intellectual exercise. And in that way, it's kind of, you know, it starts to seem a little bit more like a game in some ways than an actual practice or mode or way of living, which again, back looking at things like Epicureanism, Stoicism, and particularly what, you know, Thoreau was sort of advocating for, is like you don't live a good life or get to a good life by figuring out very highly abstract, complicated problems, right? There's no equivalency with any of that anywhere else. So why would we think there's equivalency over there? What I mean by like is like just because you're like some kind of math genius who's like, you know, solving the world's most difficult equations doesn't necessarily translate to you being like happy, healthy, fully functioning, full-fledged, you know, virtuous individual, as Aristotle would put it.
Yeah, we are coming up on the end of the show, and it's a good reminder, sort of connecting the two pieces together, right? I mean, I brought up Pierre Hadot's portrait of Theroux because I wanted to turn a kind of critical light onto the Eric Schwitzgebel studies, because the studies are purporting to try and illuminate the direction that ethics is going. And the direction is that, well, it doesn't really seem to be improving people. The interesting thing for me was always that, and we were discussing this a bit ago, and I thought that the way that you had put it, Hale, was really good, that it can almost kind of seem like the Schwitzgebel studies are just another turn of the screw, that if these are the studies that are trying to point up problems in ethics and its efficacy, well, the way that this is going, that this is being done, the way that Schwitzgebel is going about trying to show these problems is almost just a symptom of the same problem, that we are not necessarily engaged in a critical reflection about the efficacy of these problems, but more so, okay, ethicists claim that this is true. Here's evidence to the contrary. This could very much well just be further academic luxuries, as Thoreau would say, right? Where something like an honest brass tacks moral evaluation of, well, are our ethical systems really doing for us what we want them to be doing? That might be a more sort of appropriate way of going about things. And it might also not necessarily be as like systematic or broad as a study might claim. I think that this is something that if people have particular moral questions or they're seeking particular guidance or something, this seems like it would have to be very particular. Maybe the particularists can weigh in on this from the academy. But the point has been to show Hadot's portrait of Thoreau as showing a very different way of going about ethical reflection in a practical manner. I think it's been interesting. I think that the two papers do complement each other quite well. I hope we've been able to do it some justice. But in any case, you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been Brandon, and I've been joined by Hale. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin. And in June of 2022, I worked as a volunteer research assistant on a tiny island off the coast of Maine with the National Audubon Seabird Institute. This was during peak hatch, the busiest time of the year at these breeding colonies. Common terns are the predominant species here, and thousands of them were emerging from their eggs. It's a very noisy place. But every once in a while, particularly in the evenings, the chorus would suddenly go dead silent as every adult tern dove over the rocky cliffs, deserting their young. Then, rising on air currents, they return. This strange behavior is called dredging, and it's not clear why terns do it. At first, I thought it was a response to a predator, but often, there's no threat to be seen. Some researchers have suggested it's a form of social bonding for the flock to help them coordinate flight patterns for long-distance migratory journeys. Or maybe it's just for fun. If that's the case, it must be pretty entertaining because terns will stop whatever they're doing to join the dred, even if that means their hungry chicks will have to wait a few extra seconds for dinner time. Learn more about dredding at birdnote.org. I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin.
Studio 6, CJSF's video series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, you've released some demos now. The title is constantly Demos.
It's just called Demos right now, yeah.
And interviews with impactful and inspiring artists.
Well, we're going to go on a tour. Okay, we're playing Sled Island, which will be sick. We're very excited for that.
Music Waste.
And we're playing Music Waste. Also very excited for that. So that makes it easy. and I think we're going to probably record soon.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. Watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page. or on our website at cjsf.ca/studio6.